Most of you who spend any time with me know that I've spent most of my life constantly searching for ways to make changes in human behavior and feelings. I mean, when you think about it, we all want to change one or two things in our lives. We either want to change how we feel, or we want to change what we're doing. And I've constantly searched for those. And so I've mastered a whole series of technologies, you know, from earliest days with positive thinking kind of stuff, to Gestalt therapy, to neurolinguistic programming, Ericksonian hypnosis, and then now the development of some of my own neuroassociative conditioning tools. But as I've been immersed in all those things, the one thing I've always looked for is what could produce results for us at the fastest tempo? How can we create a change in an instant that really could last? And over the years, I've learned a lot of things. I've been real proud of what I've been able to share with people. But in the last 2 years alone, I've begun to focus not only how to produce changes rapidly in people, but how to produce what I call global changes. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, in essence, you could come to me and say, gosh, I want to stop biting my fingernails, or I want to be confident when I'm around, you know, authority figures, or I want to stop overeating in this situation. And using a variety of tools, again, my own, or tools like neurolinguistics or Ericksonian hypnosis, I could definitely assist you to do that and show you how to assist yourself. But I began to develop a new goal. And that goal is there an area of the mind that I could penetrate and I could help other people to penetrate within themselves without a lot of extensive detailed training that could help us to make one change that would change all kinds of things in our lives? The domino effect, if you will, a processional effect. If you could just change this one thing, many things would change simultaneously. And over the last 2 years, as I've worked on neuroassociative conditioning and my destiny technologies, I've come up with a lot of incredibly simple tools that really do produce results. Not just results in one area of your life, but often multiple areas simultaneously. So of the many tools that I've developed that I consider to be simple and powerful, things that can create change so easily that almost anyone can use them immediately, the one I want to focus on today I call global metaphors. Now you might say, Tony, already it doesn't sound that simple. What is metaphor stuff? What is a metaphor? Well, think about it. A metaphor is nothing but a figure of speech that usually implies a comparison between two things that really aren't alike. For example, you might compare the fact that you feel a little hurt inside, you might call it a broken heart. Well, it isn't really a broken heart, but by describing it that way, you certainly have an impact on how you feel. Or if you say, I'm scarred emotionally, that's a metaphor. I mean, if we took your heart out right away, we'd see it wasn't broken. And if we looked at your emotions, if there were such a thing as a thing called emotions, we'd find out they really aren't scarred. And you know what? Most of us use metaphors continuously. They're a part of the human language. They're a part of the way that we communicate. But here's the challenge. Most of us rarely notice the impact we have by using these metaphors. Now, there's all kinds of metaphors that don't create negative impact. I don't want to imply that. A lot of them create positive feelings. Sometimes we say things like, well, you're looking at me with puppy dog eyes. Doesn't that make you feel a little different than you go, quit staring at me? You know, so global metaphors are not necessarily bad. Or if you say something like, I'm tickled pink. Listen, you're not being tickled and you're not pink. But it sure feels good to use that metaphor, doesn't it? For some people, life's a bowl full of cherries. For other people, it's a war. Do you think that makes any difference in the way you look at life, the way you feel about life, the way you approach your life? See, we have metaphors for everything. Now, you may not call it metaphors, but think of a metaphor as any time you start to create a comparison. When you use a word to describe something that it really isn't. When you use a metaphor, by the way, you're taking a quantum leap and transforming your experience. Global metaphors change the way we perceive, the way that we think, the way we feel, what we experience of our lives. See, we don't experience reality. We experience our representation of reality. Again, what does that mean? Well, I've given you many metaphors to describe this. Metaphors are an easy way to teach. I give an example of how we feel is not based on reality, but what we focus on, what we represent inside our heads, how we picture things, what we say to ourselves. For instance, I think I've given you the example in the past of maybe going to meet your husband or wife for dinner one night, and you're supposed to be there at 6:30, and you get there at 6:30 and they're not there. How do you feel? Well, no problem for most people. 6:45, well, some people start to have a little change of state. 7 o'clock, some have a bigger change of state. And some people, by the way, get worried. Some people get upset. Some get angry. What's the difference? The difference is not based on reality. It's based on the way we represent reality. And in this case, it's not being done metaphorically. The person who's worried is thinking things like, oh my gosh, what if this person was hit by a car? And they may be making pictures in their mind and representing to themselves a scenario that makes them feel fearful or concerned. Whereas the person who's upset is assuming a bunch of other things. They may be upset because they're representing inside their head that, gosh, this person really doesn't care, or they're not committed, or they're off with somebody else. And we have emotional reactions to however we represent our world. Now, the person may come through the door, and it was neither of those things. It wasn't that they didn't care, and it wasn't that they were in an accident. But during that time, during the time we were focusing in that way, representing things in that way, we felt those emotions. How does this relate to metaphors? Well, realize it's not life, but the way you represent life that determines the way you feel. So when you turn around and you say, gosh, I'm scarred emotionally, that is exactly how it feels. It does not feel just hurt a little bit. It feels scarred. And that metaphor will come up to make you feel the same way again and again and again. See, oftentimes we use metaphors out of convenience without looking at their impact. Again, both positive and negative. How do we normally use metaphors? Well, we use them, number one, to learn or to teach. See, oftentimes we can't understand something because we don't have the experience of it. A metaphor is a way of transferring understanding by taking something you already understand and attaching it to a new idea. For example, many people believe, even those of different faiths, that a man named Jesus Christ was one incredible teacher. His works have survived thousands of years. And the way he taught, the way he shared ideas and understandings often was through metaphor. He adapted his style of communication so that it met the understandings of the people he was speaking with. For example, when he went to fishermen, again, he didn't say, let's go recruit Christians. He said, I want to teach you to become fishers of men. Immediately, there was a whole set of understandings about how to get the job done then, because they knew how to fish. They knew what was involved, and they could apply those understandings to impacting people. While metaphors can certainly help us to understand things much more quickly, that's one of their powers, they can also sometimes, while they're empowering us, limit us just a slight bit. Because we've got to realize our metaphor is not the same as reality, but we start responding like it's identical. And a modern example of this would be studying physics. For years, people who were studying atoms were taught that an atom is like a solar system, in that in the middle is this nucleus, which is like the sun. And then revolving around it on the outside are protons and electrons. Well, with that understanding and using that metaphor, what rules come with that metaphor? What preconceived notions? Well, one would be that these electrons and protons stayed equidistant or a certain exact distance away from the nucleus as they revolved around it. But this isn't true. They vary in distance constantly. And as a result of this, a lot of people are locked into a mindset that kept them from being able to solve certain problems in physics. So we have to be selective in the metaphors that we utilize because metaphors have tremendous power. They can help us share ideas. They can help us to share our emotion. They can intensify our emotion or lessen it depending upon which metaphor we select. I mean, think about it. All of poetry is really based on metaphor, isn't it? But we must know the impact of the metaphors we utilize, and we need to be conscious in our selection. Let's take a look at some of the impact of metaphors you may have that you're not even aware of, because you may be sitting there saying, metaphors, I don't use this word, I don't use metaphors. Oh, yes, you do. They're a living part of your language. Let's say, for example, what is life? And here's a nice way of thinking about metaphors, by the way. If you use the word is or like, those are good ways, or as, like, is, or as, are usually when you're starting to link things. You're taking something that isn't the same as what you're talking about and making it the same. So, for example, what is life like? Now, for some people, they say, well, life is like a war. Now, I want you to think about that one metaphor. If you adopt that metaphor with it, you begin to adopt a series of beliefs that affect the way you think and the way you feel about life itself. What you'd be willing to do and not do. A whole set of rules and ideas and preconceived notions come with any metaphor you adopt. So if life's a war, what's life like? Tell me. You might say, well, it's tough. Well, it means it's about death as well. You might say, well, it's going to be me against somebody else. You might say there are going to be battles. You might say, well, if life is really a battle itself, then maybe, you know, I'm going to get hurt. All of those filters will affect your decisions and your feelings. Now, some people say, no, life's not a war. It's not a battle. Life's a test, though. Well, great. What comes with the belief that life is a test? What comes with that global belief? Well, if it's a test, you know, again, maybe it's going to be tough. Maybe you better study. Maybe you better be prepared. Maybe, again, you could fail. And some people look at life as a test. For example, I was reading an article not long ago where they interviewed Donald Trump, and he was saying, well, life's a test. You either pass or you fail. If you're not in first, then you failed. Can you imagine how that metaphor has affected his decisions in his life and how he feels emotionally? For some people, life's a game. Now, if life's a game, what would you believe about life? How would that affect you as an ultimate filter to all your thinking and all your beliefs? Well, it might be fun. What a concept. It might be somewhat competitive. It might be a chance for you to really play a lot and enjoy a lot more. Some people say, well, if it's a game, then there's going to be losers. Other people say, well, it'll take a lot of skill. It all depends on what beliefs you attach to the word game, but with that one metaphor, again, you have a set of filters that are going to affect the way you think and the way you feel. What if we thought life was sacred? I hope you do think that. But if that was your primary metaphor for life, some people say, well, then it would be something that you would cherish. Other people say, well, then I'd be really careful with it. What if you thought life was a dance? Wouldn't that be a little different? What comes with life being a dance? Well, it's something beautiful. It's something you do with other people. It has grace. It has rhythm. It has joy. Maybe it has sexuality tied into it. Who knows? Maybe it's a lot of fun. I'm not saying there's a right or wrong way of looking at life. Maybe life's a gift, right? Think about how your life changes and how you look at your entire life differently just by changing the global metaphor you adopt inside your head. Are we limited to metaphors about life? Oh, no. We got metaphors about our work, for example. Some people call it, yeah, I got to go to the prison today. You think that might affect the way you feel about what you do? Other people see it as, oh, my gosh, I'm going to go be with my friends. I'm going to go join that team. I know a lot of business people who use global metaphors for their businesses, the businesses they own, and it's things like, well, it's my asset. And I look at people as either assets or liabilities. And do you think that affects the way they treat people, the way they think about people, the way they connect with people? That one belief changes it all. In my business, I think of it as a family. And you know what? That totally changes the connection I have with the people that I work with every single day because we're all one. We're all together. Some people look at it as a unified team, a team that's going to go out and win. Other people look at a business as being like a garden, where every day you've got to do things to maintain it and somehow improve it so that someday you can reap a reward. See, again, the metaphors you select will affect you tremendously. And I'm here to tell you that these metaphors are going on, whether you're aware of it consciously or not. That's the scary part, because you may have never consciously decided what metaphors you wanted to use to describe life. Where did you get your metaphors? Well, probably you picked them up from people around you. You may have picked them up from your parents or from your friends. And again, you didn't think about their impact. It just seemed convenient or fun to say, or maybe you didn't even think about it at all. It just became a habit. I'll give you an example of how I really learned all this, the power of metaphors. Because certainly I heard the word metaphors before, but I thought of metaphors as only being stories. Or maybe a quote would be a metaphor, like one that guided my life during tough times when I felt a little fearful was, you know, a ship in a harbor is safe, but that's not what ships were built for. So that's a great metaphor. It instills a belief. It makes you think of yourself like a ship, and you know you got to make it through the storms and everything else, but that's what life is for. That's what life is about. I'll never forget years ago, I was doing a seminar, a certification program, and in the middle of the seminar, about a week into it, this one gentleman jumped up and started screaming at the top of his lungs and like stabbing out at people with his bare hands like he was holding a knife. And he started saying, I'm blacking out, I'm blacking out, I'm blacking out. Well, the psychiatrist in the front row said, he's having a psychotic episode. Fortunately, I didn't take his view of things, or I would have been in deep trouble, because maybe I don't know how to deal with psychotic episodes, but I sure know how to change people's states. And I didn't know it at the time, but I know how to change people's metaphors. So I came up to this guy and I yelled, okay, then just white it out. White it out. You know how to do it. Use that stuff when you were typing. White it out. And the guy went, huh? It just totally broke his state. And all these people that were running for him paused to see what was going to happen. I said, come on, do it. You know how to use it. Just white it all out. And all of a sudden his face changed and his body changed. He started to breathe differently. And he looked at me and I said, so how's that? He said, well, he said, that feels a lot better. I said, well, sit down. And I went right on to speak. And everybody looked dumbfounded. And the psychiatrist was dumbfounded. I was kind of dumbfounded, except I had to look cool, like I knew what I was doing. So I just went on and continued, right? But what I'd done, I wasn't aware of it, is I had changed his metaphor. And by the way, I didn't have another challenge with that guy. And he came up to me 2 days later. And he said, I don't know what it was the other day. He said, but I turned 40 that day. And he said, I just lost it. Which, by the way, is that a metaphor? Losing it? How do you lose yourself? You're here. Hello? Are you here? I'm noticing. I'm talking. Let me see your hands. Now, we got to realize we oftentimes make these metaphors as if they're real. They're not real. They're just figures of speech. But we start responding to them like they're real. And he said, I just lost it. And he said, I was experiencing this unbelievable thing. Like, I felt like stabbing out and jamming out because I was in this blackness and I felt like it was swallowing me up. He said, but boy, when I put that white out on there, he said, everything just brightened right up and I felt totally different. And he said, I haven't had a challenge with it since. He said, you know, I went and read the paper that day and I started thinking of new thoughts, and he said, you know what? He said, I feel fine today. And he was fine the rest of the time just by changing one little metaphor. I didn't even know what I was doing then. Realize how easy it is to create a change. A woman came to me in a therapeutic context a few years ago, and she was a former Miss America. Very, very incredible lady, powerful woman who really cares about people. But she hadn't been able to sleep for years. Why? Well, simply because as a young girl, she was molested by her father year after year after year. I think it was from the time that she was approximately 6 or 7 years old up until the time she was about 14. And she tried to tell people and she tried to communicate it. And when she tried to bring it to the family, they all tried to deny it had happened because it was so shameful for them all. And as a result, she really beat herself up. and she'd been through every kind of therapy you can imagine. She was taking drugs to go to sleep. And so I sat down with her and I started working with her, and I said, well, you know, tell me, you know, what's going on? Why is this happening? Why can't you sleep? What's going on? And she didn't tell me at first what was going on. She first told me through metaphor. She said, I don't know, I just feel like I'm marble, like I'm stone. I'm shiny and bright on the outside, and everybody thinks I'm so wonderful, but on the inside, she said, I'm hard and I'm cold, and I can't feel anything. And I said, well, you're marble, huh? And I said, zzz, zzz, zzz. And she said, what are you doing? I said, I'm drilling holes in the marble. She looked at me like I was crazy, which immediately interrupted her pattern. I said, let's see, let's take a look in here. What do you see? Help me out. What do you see there behind that marble? And we looked at the little cracks in the marble. What happened there? She goes, well, it's really loving and warm in there. And that little thing that seems like nothing, see, when we use a metaphor, we kind of trance ourselves out. We start distorting reality. So why not distort it in a way that serves you? And as I got inside there, I started following everything she said with metaphors. And we entered in behind the marble. We jackhammered out the rest of it and got inside there and started flowing on this river of love. But it was stopped up at places. So what do you think we did? We brought out the liquid plumber and, you know, plumbed it all out and started flowing some more. And eventually we got to this room. And this is the room that kept her up at night. There was all these sounds coming out of it. And as we got closer and closer, and by my asking her questions and keeping her talking about metaphors, she told me that there was this man in the room and he was playing the piano. And I said, you know, what's he playing the piano for? And she said, I don't know. I said, well, ask him. And she said, well, it's because he's trying to keep me awake, so I'll be protected in case my dad comes. I said, well, your dad's no longer here, is he? She said, no. I said, well, look how old that guy is. Now, by the way, when people use metaphors, they're highly suggestible because their metaphors are made up anyway. She goes, yeah, he is old. I said, isn't it time for him to retire? And she looked at me and smiled, and she said, yeah. I said, well, go give him a big hug and thank him for taking such good care of you. And tell him it's time for him to retire. Tell him he can come back and play, though, but during the daytime. You know. And she did. And you know what's amazing? I'm cutting the story short for obvious reasons, but for 2.5 hours we did this, one metaphor after another, changing them and changing them and changing them. And the next day she was able to sleep without drugs for the first time. See, metaphors have more of an impact than we realize. And changing a metaphor can change your whole life. You got to discover what the metaphors are you're using so that you can change them consciously in a way that really enriches your experience of life. So what can you do if you find yourself saying things like, well, I'm at the end of my rope. Put the rope down. That's what you can do and walk away. You know, when people start doing that stuff, that's what I tell them. I go, I'm at the end of my rope. I say, well, you know, I don't say tie an iron and hang on for dear life, baby. I say, well, set the thing aside and walk over here. And they get this dumbfounded look on their face, and then all of a sudden they start to grin, and it instantly breaks their pattern. Remember, whenever we have a pattern of looking at the world or making things up in our head, if we do something radical to interrupt that pattern, and we keep interrupting it, pretty soon we can't get back to it. Anytime you find you've constructed your world in a way that creates limitations, interrupt it and replace it with power. Replace it with something that's more loving. Replace it with something that's more fun. See, if you find yourself saying things like, oh, I'm over the edge, maybe an alternative might be enjoy the slide. You know, there's all kinds of possibilities. Be creative. Be playful. Now, here's the challenge. A lot of people get like one metaphor, and they filter everything through that one metaphor. Like, everything in life is a war. Everything is a battle. It doesn't matter whether it be a relationship or whether it be their business or anything else. See, no one metaphor is the right metaphor. In fact, our real goal is to be flexible in using our metaphors. Even in my own business, where I saw my businesses as being my extended family, and I didn't call it extended, it was my family. Because of that, I do almost anything for the people in my business. I care about them tremendously. And because of that, I could never fire anybody. How do you fire a family member? You know, and sometimes I needed to. So once in a while, I had to change it and say, okay, it's not my family. What this is a vehicle to reaching and impacting people. And there are parts of this vehicle that need to be updated or maintained. Or there's parts of this vehicle that have to be taken out and reinstalled with an updated version. The bottom line is, if what you're doing isn't working, change your metaphors. Now, what are some examples of empowering metaphors? Well, one of the most empowering ones that has guided my life through tough times is the metaphor of seasons. Because when times are the toughest, you need to be able to make some kind of meaning out of that. And it's tough when you're in the midst of it. Your brain just goes, oh my gosh, this is going to go on forever. But what I began to do is, hey, life is like the seasons. And you know, I'm in winter right now. But the great thing is, if you adopt this metaphor, what always follows winter? Spring, sun comes out. You're no longer freezing to death, right? Where all of a sudden you're able to plant new seeds. You get to notice all of nature and the beauty and the life and growth and all those wonderful things. And then there's summer. You know, you're doing everything right. You planted your seeds and it's hot and it's warm and You either burn out your seed during that time if you're not careful, if you don't nurture it, or maybe you get tan. All depends on how you look at things. Once you got a metaphor, you can lay metaphors on top of metaphors. Kind of fun. And then there's fall, where you get to reap your rewards. And sometimes you've planted a seed, and you made it through the hot summer, and you get to fall, and it doesn't work out well. Well, that's true. Sometimes that happens in life, too. Sometimes before you reap, you know, a hailstorm comes in and destroys your crop. But see, if you believe in seasons, you know that you're going to get another chance. Also, as I began to look at that metaphor, I started to come up with the idea that, hey, in winter, you don't have to freeze to death. You can ski. Again, laying another metaphor on top of a metaphor. We need to find things that empower us. And during my darkest time, that metaphor almost always pulled me out. Or another one a friend of mine shared with me, who, by the way, wrote a book with a metaphor as a title. His name was Harvey McKay. It's called How to Swim with the Sharks and Not Get Eaten Alive. That's kind of a metaphor for how he felt about certain people he was doing business with and that you may be doing business with. By the way, one challenge with adopting a metaphor, you don't want to start seeing everyone as a shark. You know, seeing everybody as your friend, seeing everybody as like your puppy dog, or seeing everybody as your associate or partner in life is a great idea, except when that person is a shark. In which case, they're operating from a different set of frames. They have a different set of rules. So you don't want to see everybody as a shark, everybody's your partner. You want to see the best in people and be able to change metaphors where it's useful. But the story he shared with me is one that shaped his life. And it was about persistence, because Harvey is one of the most persistent people I know. I have tremendous respect for him. And that story is the story of the stonecutter. His father told him that the reason he would never give up and the reason his father became so successful was because he believed in stonecutting. He said, I want you, son, to become a stonecutter as well. He said, what a stonecutter does, he takes his big hammer and he smacks this giant boulder as hard as he can. And he hits it again and again and again and again. And you know what happens? He could hit it 100 times, 200, 300, and not even have a scratch. But he keep on doing it. Now, most people say, what, are you an idiot? Can't you see it's not working? But a stonecutter's smart. A stonecutter knows just because you're not getting the feedback you want initially doesn't mean you're not making progress. Pretty good belief to have. He said, you keep hitting and hitting, and at some point, maybe on the second hundred, third hundred, maybe on the 1,004th hit, the stone splits open right there. It doesn't just crack. In one hit, it breaks open. And again, it wasn't that hit that did it. It was the constant pressure being applied to the challenge at hand. So Harvey's metaphor for himself is, I'm a stonecutter. That's what makes me successful. That metaphor works for me as well, maybe for you. I know years ago I began to have this belief, and I was explaining to people that it didn't look like I was making progress, but I had my wrench on a fire hydrant, and I was pushing on that thing as hard as I could, and once it opened, it was just going to keep pouring forever with just tremendous force, and they all looked at me like I was crazy. But that metaphor kept me persistent, kept me going. Your metaphors don't have to be elegant. They just need to be effective, effective in getting you to take action. By the way, whole cultures are shaped by metaphors. A great example is if you decide to go trekking in Nepal, and you meet people along the side of the road, strangers, people you've never met before. The one thing you notice most about these people, very much like Fijians, they're incredibly loving people. These huge smiles and this warm welcome you get as if they've known you forever. And you know why? As they call to you, they call out a phrase, which in Nepalese means little brother or big brother. They just decide which one you are. I tend to get to be big brother because of my size most of the time. But whatever it is, little sister or big sister, everyone is addressed as their brother or sister. Would that change the way you approach people if that was the filter you had on every human being you met? See, as a society, we've adopted this idea about 10, 15 years ago of planet Earth or spaceship Earth. That sounded like a great metaphor, but it didn't work. You know why? You can't get emotional about a spaceship. We don't notice, we don't treat the Earth when we think of it as a spaceship the way we do when we look at it as, let's say, Mother Earth. What if you thought that everything that you received in your life, you were receiving from the breast of your Mother Earth. And that's what was nourishing your family. Some of you are like raising an eyebrow right now, but it's a different metaphor, isn't it? You'd probably be a little more sensitive. You probably wouldn't put some toxic waste right on your mother's breast, would you? You'd probably think a little different first. We've got to be really careful. We've got to think long-term in the development of our metaphors, not short-term. In fact, most boats or ships, as well as aircraft, we usually relate to them or describe them as a she, not a he. We have female names for them, or we say, take good care of her. Why don't we say her? Why don't we say, take care of him? Or, yeah, take care of Joe here, my boat. You know, we might treat it a little different, right? Yeah, I slap the thing around a little bit, but no, not a she. We're delicate. We caress her. We take care of her. We nurture her. The metaphor works. It enhances that area of life. And, you know, there are many cultures, not just the country you live in, but what you do for a living provides another culture with different metaphors. For example, oftentimes lawyers have some challenges in their personal lives and can't imagine why when they come home and try and apply the same metaphors that they use at work at home. They start to have a conversation with their wife or their husband, and next thing you know, they're trying to find out what's wrong with their argument and what their evidence is for backing up what they've said, and they try to have a debate. And that doesn't work too well in a personal relationship. Or I'll never forget working one time with a couple, one of whom was a quarterback, a star quarterback in the NFL. And he was dating and considering marrying, and she, him, a woman who was a pretty powerful movie star. And they had all these problems in their relationship, and most of them seemed to be coming from his upsets. He was upset with her all the time because she was breaking his rules. And almost all of them, though, came into focus as soon as I realized, wait a second, this guy is a quarterback. What are the rules for someone, metaphorically, who's playing a game constantly where they're a quarterback? Well, number one is, you got to run the show. You call the plays. People respond to you. You're the director. You're making things happen. And as you're moving up to become the best, you have to be the star. Even though everyone else needs to be a star too, they need to be a star with you. And so the bottom line is, this person going off on her own, deciding what she wanted for life and how she was going to be, and her being a star without having to catch a pass from him, that didn't go over too big with him. It created a lot of challenges. Or an example would be a jet pilot I did some work with. This guy is always finding something wrong with people. He's always seemed to get himself into fights. And the reason was, he thrived on having an enemy. You know, without an enemy, there is no way he could really be the best he could be. Or maybe one of my favorites, because it was so simple to make a change in, was this man who was so disassociated. His family members and his kids just couldn't get through to him, didn't feel connected to him, and they really resented him because he didn't give any feelings and he was always directing them. You know what he was? An air traffic controller. You know, as an air traffic controller, he had to make himself not be stressed. He had to stay disassociated. The guy on the radio heard his voice going, okay, well, just keep circling around for another couple hours. It'll be okay. Ah! You know, that wouldn't have gone over too big, right? So he learned to, when there's a trouble, say, yes, just make a circle and I'll get back to you. And that certain disassociated fashion works wonderful there. It doesn't work at home. So we got to be careful that we don't carry the metaphors that work in one context, like the environment we work in, into another context, like our relationships or our businesses or our families or our friends. So what are some of the metaphors that you use daily in your day-to-day life without thinking about it? Do any of them come from your work, for example? Or do you describe yourself in ways like, I'm burnt out, versus maybe you could have something like, I'm recharging? Or do you get upset and say, it's an eye for an eye? Maybe you need to come up with a different metaphor, one that's less intense. Or instead of feeling like you've got a mountain full of work to do or millions of things to do, maybe you've got a few things to do, and you start taking that mountain and representing it as a stack. Maybe that'd feel a little different. You know, you want to make sure you set yourself up to win the game, and the way to win the game is pick the right metaphor. Let's take a second look at relationships. What are the metaphors you have for relationships? Is the person you're in a relationship with your partner in life? Are they your team member? Are they your lover? Are they your better half? Or do you talk about them as your dictator, the old ball and chain, the old lady, the old man, you know, that jerk and idiot I live with? You know, do you think those metaphors might make a difference in how they feel? I'll never forget, I had this one lady on a date with Destiny seminar. Every time she talked about her husband, she talked about this jerk I'm with, this idiot. And so I turned to her and I said, ma'am, I'm sure you have a lot of challenges, and I'm sure this man has made a lot of mistakes, and I know you haven't made any. But I'm just curious, do you think your relationship's going to get any better as long as you hold that he's a jerk and an idiot? I said, also, notice what's happening here. You call him a jerk and idiot, and the times he's talked about you, I hear him say things like, you're the love of his life, or you're his better half, or you're his gift from God. Maybe you ought to re-examine the metaphor you're using to describe him to yourself and to other people, and pick something that's more appropriate. Because sometimes we use a metaphor so often, it becomes habitual, and we start thinking the metaphor is real, and it's just not. How about kids? What are your metaphors for your kids? Are they the rugrats? You know, one of my friends who obviously doesn't have kids used to have a metaphor, he called them barfers. You know, because all kids do. Whenever you're around, they barf all over you. So as long as you hold that metaphor, can you imagine how he responded? He just recently, by the way, got to fill in for Santa Claus at a department store, and he didn't want to do it. A bunch of us put him up to it and set him up so he had to do it. He got to have hundreds of these barfers come and sit on his lap. And you know what? Most of them, with one exception, didn't barf. And the bottom line is, he got a whole other view of what children were about. And he got to change his metaphor. And I called them cuddlies. And even get my change the way you feel? You better believe it. Brats doesn't usually make you want to have more of them, nor does it make you want to take good care of them or nourish them. So you got to really make sure you got the appropriate metaphor in each area. Now, how about the metaphors for your body? What is your body? Is it a machine? Is it a disaster? You know, is it an opportunity for growth? Is it a vehicle? Is it the temple? See, most people don't treat it like it's a temple. There was a gentleman who we learned to call Maestro. And Maestro was just this wonderful guy. who was extremely overweight. They've been trying to lose weight through every diet you can imagine. But when I got him up on stage and we did one of these things I call the rules realignments, a special technique we have for changing the rules that your brain uses to make decisions, as we got through it, it became clear that he associated being fat to being spiritual. Because he had all these metaphors of that in order to be spiritual, what you had to do is be like the giant guru, you know, in India. And so sure enough, he actually linked that to me more. And he thought, you know, if you're this big, then the only people that are going to get through to you are spiritual people because other people are going to be turned off by your fat. And he said, I really think that, you know, he said, I know it doesn't make any sense, but he says, it just feels real to me that fat equals spiritual. And I saw, so I gave him a metaphor. I said, well, I don't think that. He said, I think God loves fat people. I said, well, you know, I think God loves everybody, but I think what he does with fat people is he just sticks them on a skewer and roasts them above hell. You should have seen his face. Now, obviously, I don't believe this, but it was a major pattern for him. And he got the picture in his head. It was pretty intense. And we began to work on a better metaphor for his body because he said his body was nothing. So, well, what is your body? What's it like? He said, it's like nothing. It's like just there. It's like, it's just a vehicle. I said, is it a quality vehicle? He said, well, it doesn't matter if you have quality vehicles as long as it gets you there. So we got him to adopt the idea of a temple. And you know what? That was the only major change. With that, a bunch of his rules changed. Because when he went to pick up food, he said, would I put this in a temple? By the way, he's lost 90 pounds in the last 90 days simply by adopting that metaphor and adopting it fully. I mean, living it every single day. It's become habitual to him. And he said that once in a rare while, if he finds himself going down an old aisle that used to be familiar, he just pictures that body in a skewer above hell. And he said, that's all it takes is a metaphor to knock him right out of it and get him out of those aisles he doesn't belong in. One of the most important distinctions that I made about global metaphors, having utilized them so much and worked with people on an ongoing basis, is that whether people know it or not, they've got global metaphors for themselves. They have metaphors for what they do for a living. And the challenge is, if you don't consciously select your own metaphors, then what happens is your environment tends to create the metaphors for you. And sometimes those metaphors are disempowering, not empowering. I know for myself, for example, you know, people used to ask me, well, what do you do? What are you exactly? I mean, you're not a psychologist, and, you know, are you a motivator? And I said, no, I'm not a motivator because I'm not a motivator. What a terrible metaphor. You know, you pump somebody up, and, you know, a little bit later they drop right back down again. You know, it's like taking a warm bath, and I've never considered myself just to be a motivator. Hopefully what I do helps people to motivate themselves by having them change some of their core beliefs and helping them develop strategies on how to produce consistent and specific results. But being a motivator is not what I want to be known as. So some people say, well, gosh, if you don't know what you are, I know what you are. You're a guru. I got to see that in Life magazine and newspapers. And sometimes to this day, media will cover me as the guru of something. I don't want to be somebody's guru. And I'm not any better than anybody else. And I'm not here to go out in the world and be everybody else's leader they're going to come pay homage to. That's not what I'm about. So I thought, well, I'm a teacher. But I thought, oh, no, I'm more than just a teacher. You know, humble as I am, there's got to be something more. And somebody said, you're a comedian. I thought, well, that's a nice compliment, but there's some serious stuff here. So I finally came up with, I'm a peak performance consultant. Well, that's accurate, but it's not very emotional. It didn't really create the emotion inside of me. We all need to find a metaphor for describing who we are, what we do. And one day I finally got it. I'm a coach. I thought, that's really what I am. What is a coach? To me, a coach is somebody who really cares. It's somebody who's warm and committed, and they're your friend. They also are the person that's going to challenge you. They're not going to let you off the hook just because they're your friend. They're the kind of person who knows. They've got knowledge and they've got experience. They've been there before. They have lots of distinctions. And the key is, yes, they do teach you new information, new strategies, and new skills, and how to get results that are measurable. But a good coach affects your beliefs. And a good coach gets you to not only know what to do, they get you to do what you know. And that's when results really change in our lives. And I thought, that's what I am. And by the way, a coach isn't any better than the people they're coaching. In fact, some coaches coach people that are better than them. They just seem to have a few distinctions because that's been their area of focus. And you know what? As soon as I started using that metaphor for what I was, that I'm a success coach, I helped to coach people on how to achieve what they really want more quickly and more easily. It changed the way I thought about myself. It made my work warmer. It made me enjoy everything I was doing. I said, yeah, that's why I'm a coach. I've also found that having metaphors to describe what my seminars are really helped me out tremendously to be more effective and help me to translate to other people what they were really about. Now you say, well, that's just in the seminar business, right? Wrong. It's true of your business. It's true of your avocation. You've got to create a metaphor that creates a greater sense of richness and joy and fun and playfulness. Then you'll get more out of yourself. I'll give you an example that's measurable. I know several years back, PIE, the trucking service, they had some major challenges, and they found that 60% of all their shipping contracts were erroneous. It was costing them more than $250,000 a year. Well, they did an intensive study, and they found out that 56% of these errors were based on misidentification of containers. Well, they brought in a man named Dr. Deming, the man who's both famous and infamous in American culture. He's an American consultant who went over to Japan and whose philosophies on management and quality have been adopted wholeheartedly by the Japanese. In fact, they give away each year the Deming Award. It's the highest award a Japanese company can receive, and it is always broadcast on national television. In fact, over there, it said in the Wall Street Journal that Deming is considered to be up there right next to God, at least in the business circles. The bottom line is, based on their understanding of Deming's work, they decided to change the view that the workers had of themselves to get them to be more quality-oriented. And instead of seeing themselves as workers or truckers, they started telling people, you know what you guys are? You're craftsmen. At first, people looked at it kind of funny, but then they got hooked on the idea. They said, yeah, I'm a craftsman. And they kind of teased each other and smiled about it. But you know what? When you adopt a metaphor, along with it, you adopt a set of rules of how to think about yourself and how to behave and what to do. As a result, in less than 30 days, they cut their 60% erroneous shippings down to less than 10%, saving more than $250,000 a year. Metaphors pay. Metaphors make the difference in how you feel. Metaphors change the way other people see you. Select them carefully. Select them intelligently. Select them in a way that deepens and enriches the experience of your life and the people you care about. Become a student of metaphors and become sensitized to them, and your whole life can change. Anytime you hear a metaphor that creates limits, just step in and offer a new one. Offer a new possibility. Break a pattern and give them a new choice, including yourself. Take out your journal, and I want you to write down the following. Number one, what is life? And I want you to come and write down, number one, the metaphors you already linked to it. In other words, life is like what? It's as if life was what? And just brainstorm everything you think of it, because I bet you got more than one metaphor you link to life. When you're in a lousy state, you probably call it a battle or a war. When you're in a good state, maybe you think of it as a gift. But I want you to write them all down. And then I want you to decide, out of the list that you make, if life is this, then what does it mean to me? Like, if life is sacred, what does that mean? If life is a dream, what does that mean? If all the world's a stage, what does that mean? Each of your metaphors, by the way, will have benefits and they may have limitations. And all the world's a stage may be great because it may mean that, hey, you get a chance to go out there and make a difference and do something and you'll be heard. But also may make you be a person that's always performing. You don't want to be that. You want to be real. So take a look at the metaphors you have available. I want you to also make a list, number two, of all the metaphors you link to relationship or marriage. Take a look at those metaphors. Are they empowering or disempowering? And then again, just being aware of your metaphors can change them. See, conscious awareness alone can transform things because your brain will start to say, ah, that doesn't work. That's ridiculous. And you can adopt a new one so easily. That's the beauty of this technology. It's so darn simple. And thirdly, I want you to pick another area of your life that impacts you most, whether it be your business, whether it be your family or your children, whether it be your ability to learn. What are your metaphors for what learning is? So I want you to pick the third one for yourself, but write down the metaphors you currently use, brainstorm them out, look at their impact. Ask yourself, what are the consequences, positive consequences and negative consequences of this metaphor? And then after you've done that, see if you can't create some new ones you've never thought of before and decide, from now on, I'm going to think of life as these four or five things to start with at least. Life is not a war. Life is not a test. Life is a game. Life is a dance. Life is sacred. Life is a gift. Life is joy. Whatever it is for you. And decide you're going to live those for the next 30 days. So if somebody asks you, how's it going? You might turn back to them and say, the gift is being enjoyed. I look at you and say, what? So nothing. Just my global metaphor for life. We're ultimately in control of our destiny by the decisions we make about what things mean and what we're going to do. See, it's easy to get seduced in life and say, well, the reason I'm not achieving what I want is because XYZ happened when I was a child, or someone didn't give me the resources I really wanted, or because the weather's this way, or because the economy's this way. But the reality is, it's never the events, it's always us. So, what controls that? Well, you and I have a system, an unconscious system for evaluating what things mean and what we should do. It's determining our actions every single day, and therefore our destiny. And it has five parts to it. Number one, the state that you're in. The state you're in mentally and emotionally at any moment in time is going to radically shift the way you interpret what things mean and what you're going to do. Hey, if you're in a frustrated state, you and I both know things don't carry the same meaning as when you're feeling really loving and happy and excited. You interpret it totally differently just by state alone. Secondly, the questions you ask yourself. constantly affect what you're evaluating, what you focus on, and the meaning that you take from it. Whether you ask yourself disempowering questions like, how come I always screw things up? And having your brain respond by saying, because you're an idiot. Or whether you ask questions like, how can I turn this around? How can I utilize this experience to make my life greater? That changes completely what you focus on, what things mean, and what you're going to do with your life. It changes the event immediately and gives you control. The third element is values. See, the values that you hold constantly determine what you pay attention to most, what you try to move towards in your life. Is your life focused on contribution? Is your life focused on love or security or adventure or passion or success? Whatever it is, it's pulling you in a direction and shaping your destiny. You also have certain things you value because you want to avoid them. Certain emotional states like avoiding frustration or anger or humiliation or feeling like you're bored. All of these emotions also shape what we want to move away from in our lives, and therefore they affect the direction of our lives and our destiny. The fourth element in our system of evaluating what things mean to us and what we're going to do in our life is our belief systems. We have a whole variety of beliefs about ourselves, about other people, about possibility, about capability. We also have specific rule beliefs. Beliefs that say, if you do this, then it means that. If you don't do this, then it means something else. All of these preconceived notions that we've developed within ourselves are filtering our experience of life on a daily basis. And different beliefs create a different destiny. If you hold the belief that people are rotten, no good, and they'll take advantage of you if you give them half a chance, obviously you're going to make different decisions as to what to focus on, what things mean when people do things, and what you're going to do about it. Then if you had a belief that said something like, people are basically good, they really do care, if you give them half a chance, they'll go for it. So we've talked about these issues in the past. But the one we've not talked about is the fifth element, references. You see, where do you think your beliefs have come from? Where do you think your values came from? You came from references. Well, what is this big word, references? References are nothing but the experiences of your life. But your experiences can be broken down into many different ways. There are the experiences that you've had consciously and the experiences you picked up unconsciously. Those little things that you never noticed that have filtered inside your brain. Your references aren't just limited to the story of your life, but quite literally, your references might be considered metaphorically as like a giant file box in your brain where everything you've ever seen, heard, tasted, touched, or smelled is all stored. Now, some of those references are organized. You put them together to come up with a specific meaning to help you make decisions in the future. And those organized references we call beliefs. So wait a second, now I'm really confused. Well, think about it. What is a belief? A belief is nothing but a feeling of certainty about what something means. If you say, I believe I'm really intelligent, you're saying, I feel certain I'm intelligent. What makes you certain? You have references. Yeah, you've had experiences in your life where you learned something, or you took on a challenging environment and you were able to master it, or maybe somebody told you that you were intelligent, or you passed some tests. All of those experiences take the idea, the simple idea that maybe you don't believe to start with that you're intelligent, and make them solid by putting these legs underneath it. Think of references like the legs of belief. They make a belief solid, they make it real, they make you believe it, they make you feel certain about what something means. To give you a clearer picture, think of an idea as being like a tabletop that has no legs. It's not very solid, pretty wobbly. But the way we take that idea, whatever it is, let's say the idea is that you're sexy. The only way you're going to believe you're sexy is if you feel certain you're sexy. Now, I know you already believe this, so this is probably a moot point. But let's take it as an example. You just say, I'm sexy. You can say that and not believe it, not feel certain that it's true. But if you do say, I'm sexy and believe it, that is, you feel that certainty inside, why do you? Because underneath that tabletop, you got some references. Now, I'm not going to call on these people, but I'm sure you have some, right? You have some people you've had some experiences with who told you what a great, sexy person you were. Maybe, you know, you looked in the mirror one day and you compared it with some other picture of somebody else and said, I'm so much sexier than him or her. I don't know what you've done, but I'm sure you got plenty of those things. Or maybe somebody looked across at you while you were in bumper-to-bumper traffic and kind of got your attention and smiled at you and pointed at you. And you said, see, that means I'm sexy. The truth is, they were telling you to move, but you interpreted it as a reference that you were sexy. The point is really simple. We can take references for virtually anything and make them back up any idea we want. Hey, I got a question for you. Do you have references to back up the idea that people are rotten and they'll take advantage of you if you give them half a chance? Now, I know maybe you don't have personal references, but have you read about people who have done this? Have you heard about people who have done this? Have you ever had any experiences in your life? I know you don't believe it, but do you have references to back it up? Yes or no? You and I both know the answer is yes. Don't you also, though, have references to back up the idea that people really do care, and if you give them half a chance, they'll want to help you? If you don't have them personally, you certainly have read about them. The other day I heard about a man on television again, found $35,000 and returned it and refused to even be on camera. He just said it was the right thing to do and had to give it back. And it turned out it was the life savings of a 68-year-old woman. But he didn't want anybody to know he'd done it. Why? Because he has some references in his background as to what that would mean if he were to take credit. And maybe it's different than you. You might say, well, why would he do that? I mean, you know, he doesn't have to boast about it, but why wouldn't he at least, you know, come on camera and say, I just thought it was the right thing to do. Why wouldn't he do that? See, if you've ever wondered why people do what they do, why they do something different than you, I have the answer. References. They have different references than you do. They've organized those references based on their life experiences to develop some beliefs. They believe if they were to do certain things in a certain way, it would mean something good or it would mean something bad. And all of our beliefs, based on the references of our life, are shaping our life moment to moment. It's literally directing our destiny. So maybe we should take control of this process. Think of it metaphorically. All the different reference experiences of your life, both the good and bad, the challenging and the exciting, all of these have been woven together to create the fabric of your life. And from that fabric, you've made decisions about beliefs and values that you were going to cut from that fabric. In other words, there's plenty of fabric there. You can shape it any way you want. You can create whatever beliefs or values you decide to in the moment. But the decisions you've made out of those references as to what shapes to pull out are going to determine what you sew together to shape the quality of life you have today and ultimately your destiny. Probably one of the most valuable things that references do for us is they help us to have a feeling of certainty when we go about doing something. Otherwise, we'd live our whole life afraid or in doubt. What would allow you right now to get up and step down on the floor and not be worried about whether the floor would support you or not? References. You got plenty of them. What would disturb you if suddenly the book in front of you began to float across the room? The other thing that would disturb you is it doesn't match your references. Why will a baby reach into a dirty ashtray, pull out a cigarette butt, and chew on it? Why? Because they don't have references to know it's not good for them. The bottom line is our references are shaping our life. And the problem is most of us are not paying attention to how we're interpreting our references, much less focusing on how do we get the references we need in order to succeed and achieve our goals. Hey, don't certain goals require certain references? Don't you have to have certain experiences, certain understandings, certain strategies in order to succeed? Well, think about it. References are not limited to our own conscious experience of life. References come in many shapes and types and sizes. We have the references of our past, yes. We have the references of the experiences of our present, but we all have the ability to pull references from our future. You might say, well, what do you mean by that? I mean, references are not limited to your actual experience. Your imagination is a source of references. Anyone who's created anything had to create a sense of certainty within themselves that they could achieve, that they could go. How did Columbus get himself to be able to come here? And he had to develop some references, and there weren't any. So what did he do? He unleashed his imagination. Your imagination is 10 times more powerful than your willpower. Our imagination unleashed can give us a sense of feeling and certainty and vision that goes far beyond the limitations of our past. And we're not limited to references as far back as 1492. We can come into the modern day. Lee Iacocca created references for himself and for everyone around them to believe that Chrysler could make it so that our Congress would be willing to put money in to support that organization in turning itself around. You know, recently I received a book from Mr. Morita, the person who wrote the book Made in Japan. He's basically the co-founder of Sony, an unbelievably brilliant man. And he said one of the toughest and most important decisions he made in his life was when Bulova Company came to him and offered to buy 100,000 transistor radios when his company was just getting going and they had the breakthrough radio. Well, at the time, they weren't even doing 10,000 units a month. The amount of money involved was worth tenfold what his company was worth at the time. It was an unbelievable deal, and yet he walked away from it. Why? You say he's crazy. The company's barely surviving. He can't do that. But what they wanted to do was put Bulova's name on those radios. And Mr. Morita said, there is no way I'm going to do this. And they said, look, you can still make your own radios too and put your name on them. We've been around for 50 years. You can benefit by putting this out. You can get the capital to expand your business. He said, yes, sir, that's true, but I'm going to turn you down and say no. He said, because 50 years from now, my company's name will be as big as yours, and I know this radio is going to help us to develop that name. Now, everyone around him told him he was crazy, even his partners. They said, this is insane. How was he able to create the certainty to make that tough a decision, which, by the way, again, he said is probably the most important decision he's made in his career? He did it by using his imagination. He focused in his mind on what he wanted things to be like, and he believed with absolute faith and certainty his vision. You see, the memories of your past are just pictures in your head. They're sounds, they're sensations that you generate. You feel them when you focus on them. Can you not also focus on how you want things to be and focus on it so continuously till it feels just as real to you and gives you the kind of certainty to take the actions that are necessary to succeed? Because you haven't done something doesn't mean you can't. Because you've tried something again and again and again and failed doesn't mean the next time you won't succeed. The past does not equal the future. Thomas Edison attempted to make the electric light bulb thousands of times. He could have taken all those experiences of things not working out and called them failures. Instead, he used every one of those as a reference for himself that he was getting closer to the solution. So again, references are invaluable, but in essence, it's what we choose to do with them that determines our life. Your past is a place you can learn from, but it's not a place you want to live. See, it's a place to spring forward from. And what doesn't work, throw it away. It's never too late to have a happy childhood. Whatever you're feeling is what you're focusing on, and you're in control of that process. So remember, while the fabric may be there, there are unlimited references, and they're not just your past. You're not limited to even your own personal experiences as references. You can borrow the references of other people. Most of my life early on, I didn't have the references that I could be a great success or that I could achieve on major scales or I could go out and turn things and people around. I did it with my imagination. I did it by reading stories of people that were succeeding and saying, hey, they've done this, and seeing where they really started and that hard work was really a part of it and that they kept their vision, they persisted, and they didn't give up. Those references made it real for me. So you can borrow from Emerson. When you read great poetry or when you read a great book, the power of it is as you read the book, you start thinking like the author. You start to feel like they feel, think like they think. You begin to imagine the way they imagine. You begin to develop those references as well. That's the power of culture. That's the power of literature, of a good play, of music. That's why we want to constantly be expanding our references, exposing ourselves to things that maybe we don't think we're going to like, and all of a sudden you find out you love them. I'll never forget one time I used to think, I don't want to go to a play. And one day I went and saw a play years ago called Les Miserables. Wow. One of the most powerful references of my life. I got to tell you, I have never seen or read or heard anything that moved me as deeply as that play did. I mean, I love the power and the majesty that human beings can translate through so many different areas, through story, through music, through drama. See, we want to expose ourselves to all of those things. We don't want to prejudge. You know, I've done a lot of things that were lousy, too. But my attitude is if I can get one idea from it, if I can get one feeling, one experience, one exposure, it expands me. Limited references create a limited life. You want to expand your life? Expand your references consciously by pursuing other ideas and experiences that you haven't currently been exposed to. Experience is an invaluable tool, and you can pull so much from others as well. And we all are going to have times in our life where something's going to happen we have no references for how to deal with. And instead of just sitting there and giving up or saying, you don't know how bad it is, and telling them how terrible your life is, what eventually you must do is stand up and create those references or seek them out. See, no matter how bad you think things are in your life, somebody else has got it worse. No matter how well it's going, somebody else is doing better. Use contrast to move yourself forward. See, the only danger that destroys the quality of our lives are destructive beliefs. So when you start believing the way you're supposed to be is immobilized by pain or by problems, or that because you've got so many challenges no one else can understand, or because you've had a loss of a friend or a business or a goal or a dream for the moment or forever, that your life is over. When we start adopting those kinds of beliefs, our life ends. Instead, we must seek out references. And again, somebody out there can help you to feel better, if not by showing you that they're feeling worse. I mean, all you got to do is look around. You know, for example, I talked to somebody recently who works within our fortune management team, and the guy's really stressed out because he's making $150,000 a year as a doctor. Now, when he started with us 3 years ago, he was making $13,000 a year, and he was stressed out. The difference is now his stress is things like, gosh, they want to go to Paris this year, and he's not sure if he can do that on top of a couple other things that he wants to do. He doesn't have quite enough time to be able to run his practice, give the quality he's committed to his patients, and be able to take off as much time as he'd like to. That's his stress. And he's getting as stressed out now about that as he used to when he was trying to figure out how he could survive, how and if he was going to be able to send his kids to college, and when he was ever going to be able to have any time off. He was working 6 to 7 days a week. Now he works 4 to 5. I mean, we lose perspective. And if I ever start to lose perspective because I think I'm working so hard, and I do it just like you. We all do. The way I try and balance myself out is a little contrast. And the thing I do with my family, if we ever get out of balance, and I remind them of an experience we all shared. There was a gentleman who attended one of our seminars not many years ago who was just a really warm, gentle soul. He wasn't an outstanding personality that dominated or achieved or pushed, but you were touched by his gentleness. He was a wonderful man. And one day, I got a note from one of our graduates who picked up a newspaper article outside of Toronto, Canada, and there was an article that I read that definitely affected our lives. And the gentleman's name was Joe Fritsch. And Joe, I guess one day, decided to pull into a gas station, and he didn't know what was about to take place. Two men who had escaped from prison had been out for a while and decided that they didn't like the outside world. Their idea of their references they were comfortable with was prison life. They thought they wanted to be free, but when they got out there, they didn't like the way it felt. They didn't like being on the run. So their idea of how to get back was to murder someone, to kill the very next person who came into the gas station. Didn't matter if it was a man, woman, or child. Joe was in the wrong place at the wrong time, or maybe the right place at the right time, depending upon what you believe spiritually. Bottom line, they murdered him right there. He left 5 children and his wife. Can you imagine? And you think you have problems? You have no problems. That family had some problems. You know what's unbelievable? The amount of love and support and caring. I called his widow and I spoke to her on the phone. I'd never met her before and tried to offer any way I could support. And she talked to me about how deep the pain was, but I also realized the most important thing in this event was the meaning that she and the children were going to pull from this, because this was a reference that would shape their destinies. But how it shaped their destinies was not the event, but what were they going to pull from it? What was it going to mean? They had the power to decide. And I asked her that. I said, what is this going to mean to you? She said, I guess it could mean that people are horrible and destructive, and you can do everything right, and life can still take advantage of you. And I held my breath, thinking, how can I help her to see another meaning? And she said, but I realize if I teach my kids that, and if I believe that, then there's no reason to live. And she said, I just can't believe that. She said, we've received too much love and too much support. You cannot believe the hundreds of letters that we've received and people in the community coming to support us. And she said, well, it's so painful right now. She says, I know it must have happened for a reason. She said, I don't have a way to back it up. It's just my faith. She had to borrow from the future. She had to borrow. Her faith is the ultimate reference. She knew if she didn't do this, it would destroy her own life as well as her children's forever. And she knew she had to stand up and dig deep inside and find a meaning where no meaning seemed to exist. What a powerful woman. How lucky those children are. I asked her, I said, what do you talk to the children about? She said, I want you to notice, kids, notice all these people and how much love they're giving, that people are really good. That there are a few people in the world that are really bad, they're messed up, they're screwed up, and they need to be helped. But that your dad always believed in God, and he's gone to a better place. And he had things to do while he was here, and his time was up. But our time is not up. We've got to take advantage while we're here. What this should remind us is that every day we've got to live to our fullest together. And we can't look at losing him because he'll always be with us. Wow. How fortunate these kids are. Maybe a lesson we could all remember. And if you start feeling like, well, gosh, I'm not making as much money as I think I should, maybe a little perspective would help by having the references of other people. By the way, I'm not making you feel bad if you're feeling bad about things. I'm just saying if you decide you're tired of feeling bad, easy way to feel good is go get some other references. And if you have no way to back something up, faith is still the ultimate reference. Always return to that. You've got to be willing to trust. So look through other people's references and realize that your references are not real. They're only what you've focused on. In any situation, although the references of your life, like being abused or being loved or having somebody leave an early age or come into your life an early age, all those things are real, and yet what you pulled from them is what's going to shape your life. And it all depends on what you focus on. What's real is what you focus on. That's all that's real in your life. So you better make sure that you don't blame your references for where you are, but you take advantage of the references you have. And if you don't have strong enough references, create them or go get them. We all have that capacity. And I'm here to tell you that every great leader, every person that succeeded ever in their life has found themselves in places where they didn't know what to do, and they made the references up or they went and got them. It's up to you to take control. I'm also here to tell you that if you don't take control of this process, you're going to pay a big price. See, it's easy in life to get caught up in Niagara. We've talked about it so many times, right? You jump on the river of life, and you have an idea where you're going, and you think you know where you're going, but hey, some things along the way knock you off course. And before you know it, sometimes we get caught up in the current of life, current demands, current fears, current challenges. And pretty soon we get to the forks in the river, and we don't know where we're going. We let the river decide for us. We let the river of our despair, the river of our challenge, the river of demands of people around us, and we don't make conscious choices. We start acting like everybody else, and if you do everything like everybody else, if you respond to despair and to challenge and disappointment and frustration like everybody else, then you're going to end up like everybody else. Most people are not happy. Most people are not in control of their life. One out of two are in divorces, right? Less than 10% like their body and say they're at their ideal weight. You know, we're in a society where people are popping drugs and alcohol and food all to try to change the way they feel because they haven't learned to master it. Most people are so caught up in the river, this thing called life, that one day they wake up having been swept by the river and realize they're 5 feet from Niagara Falls in a boat with no oars, and they say, oh, shoot, but it's too late. Now is the time to take control of your life upstream. Now is the time to say, I want to experience all of life, and the painful experiences of life that are there, I'm going to pull some value from. Now is the time to decide that the focus of your life is going to be on utilization. That whatever life gives you, you'll find a way to use it to your advantage, to the advantage of others. That's the only way in life to feel rewarded and fulfilled. It's the only way to guarantee that this life has joy continuously. By the way, does this mean that you're never going to get down? You're never going to get frustrated? You're never going to feel despair? Of course not. You're going to feel those things, and you have the right to. But when you do, realize that they're a message, and the message is that you've got to change what you're focusing on, the way you're interpreting this thing, your perception about this, or you got to take some action right now to utilize what's happened. I also want to remind you that if you take the events of today and put a meaning on them immediately, you may be prejudging whether this is a good day or a bad day in your life. See, I'm here to tell you that some of the worst days in your life, you thought, are some of the best. Think about it for a second. Think of one of the worst experiences that's ever happened in your life, one of the very worst. As you think back to that experience, be honest with yourself. Isn't it true, if you look back on it now, that the truth is in some way it's positively shaped your life? Maybe it's made you more sensitive and more caring about other people because you were abused as a child, or maybe it's made you make sure that you treated your children totally different and it shaped their destiny for the good. Maybe because when you didn't have freedom when you were a kid, it drove you to create more freedom for other people. Maybe because you didn't have respect, you're more respectful. Maybe because you didn't have love, you're more loving. Maybe because something happened that was horrible, it just changed the entire direction of your life. Now you might say, yeah, that's true. Then maybe your bad days aren't so bad after all, as you look back on them. And you might say, no, Tony, I've had some things that there's no way I can ever get over these. I'll always have pain for these. You're right. As long as you hold that they mean something like you've been taken advantage of or you have a loss that can never be returned. Just remember, loss is imaginary. Everything you think you've lost is an imagination because everything in the universe only changes form. Nothing ever disappears. What you got to remember is if there's something you've still not gotten over, it's because of the meaning you've linked to it. And maybe what you need to do is get some faith in there and say, even though I don't know why this has happened, I'm willing to trust. I'm willing to trust that someday I will. I'm willing to trust my Creator. That's a big leap. It's called a leap of faith. But it's the one that every one of us has to meet at some time in our life if we're going to move to the next level. And I got to tell you, every day you and I got to use faith. We got to use faith to be able to survive and to succeed. I remember reading a story recently about Billy Joel, where it was talked about how years ago when he was 21, 22 years old, how he was ready to commit suicide. Unfortunately, he got himself into a hospital. You want to know why he was going to commit suicide? Because he'd been in these bars where he'd been playing his piano, you know, his piano man songs, where people sit there and they don't listen and they're drunk and they spit all over you and they don't appreciate you. He'd been doing that since I think he was 16, 17 years old. Here he was, 22. My gosh, think of that, 6 straight years of heck like that. You know, not being able to really feel any fulfillment, no direction, nobody liked his music, and the only thing in his life that gave him any brightness was he felt he found the girl of his dreams, and then she left him. He's ready to commit suicide. Why? Because he knew he'd never amount to anything, and he'd never find a woman as beautiful as her. What kicked him out? New references. When he checked into that mental institution, he found out what real pain was. He got in that environment where he couldn't even turn his back on people. And he thought to himself, I have no problems, and I will never let myself get that down again. He said it's ridiculous, and he never has. The rest is history. Just remember, God's delays are not God's denials. What appears to not be working out right now, what seems to be a horrible event, may in fact be a reward. It may be a blessing. Returning back to Made in Japan with Mr. Sony, Mr. Morita, he talked about in the very beginning of his company, before it was even known as Sony, that right after the war, they wanted to make these wire recorders, and they couldn't get anyone to make the wire for the recorders they were developing because no one was willing to bet on such a small, tiny little company that wouldn't succeed. And they tried everything they knew, and it looked like they couldn't build the recorder. Thank goodness. But because of that, they eventually found tape recorders and became one of the biggest makers of them in the world. See, what seemed like a horrible event turned out to be a benefit. Just remember, the next time you're feeling bad, you're going to have good days and you're going to have bad days. The only thing is, you're not going to know which ones they really are until much later in your life. So at this point, you might say to me, then, Tony, how do I know what's really true? How do I know what I really should believe? Well, think about it this way. Beliefs are designed to empower you to take effective action so that you can grow and expand and make a difference for yourself and the people you care about. What should you do? You should look for beliefs that will empower you. It's not whether a belief is accurate or not, because you can back up a feeling of accuracy on almost any belief. Hey, in any argument, you can always get somebody to back up your view. You can always find a way. If you talk to somebody who says, yeah, well, I have the statistics, say, yeah, and I've read the book called How to Lie with Statistics. Most attorneys have it. There really is such a book, and it'll show you how to manipulate any kind of statistic. So I'm here to tell you that we need to find the statistics and the experiences in life that cause us to constantly grow and expand, that cause us to move to the next level, that cause us to utilize life's challenges and turn them into life's opportunities. That's what you and I have to do continuously. Remember, people can rationalize anything. Remember what we talked about earlier. You've got references to back up the idea that people are terrible and mean and they'll take advantage of you, and you give yourself to feel certain and prove that's true, and you've got the references to back up the idea that people really care. If you give them half a chance, they'll support you. So what you're going to believe is what is empowering, and that's the key question you might want to learn to ask yourself. If you feel like you're overwhelmed or overloaded or you can't get through it or you don't know how to turn things around or you're really mad at somebody or you're stuck in a lousy pattern, a good question to ask yourself is, what would I have to believe in order to feel this way? See, if you ask that question, your brain may say things like, well, I'd have to believe that I'm totally out of control and that I don't direct my own life. And there's probably a belief inside of you that's contrary to that. One that says, that's garbage. And the minute you hear that, the minute you notice it, the awareness alone can be curative. Just seeing that, you can say, oh, this is garbage. No way. I don't believe that. And you can move on. It can break your pattern. See, oftentimes we organize our references in a way that limit us. Remember what I said earlier? Limited references create a limited life. There's a term in sociology that we should all become more familiar with, and it's called ethnocentricity. What does it mean? It means we all run around thinking our references are the only references for the world. I mean, for example, what do you think would happen if one day I said, hey, let's go to lunch, and we walked into a particular third world country, and I won't say which one just to not aggravate certain people of that nationality, but I'll tell you there are many countries in the world where this is true, one specifically I'm thinking of. We could go in and there are cages in the room, and there are dogs in those cages. And we go up to the counter and I say, we'll take that one. And sure enough, they take out the dog, they cut its throat right there, and they begin to skin it and cook it. You say, oh my gosh, I can't believe this. These people are killing this poor dog. And look at these people around. You begin to realize that all the people sitting there, it's in a little mini type of restaurant, and they're all eating dog. You say, this is crazy. Is it? I would tend to agree with you. But how do you think an Indian feels when they come and see you eating cow right in front of them? An Indian who has a belief that that is a holy creature that you're putting inside your body. I guess it all depends on references, what you believe, huh? Maybe the next time you get really upset with somebody, maybe one of the ways you can at least have some compassion and understanding is to see that, you know, they probably have different references than you do. Now, that's not an excuse, but at least can allow us to have a better understanding of each other, of people, because it is true. You could have the same references and have interpreted them differently. And you could have come out totally differently based on the same situation, but compassion is going to get us a lot further. If you don't understand, and if I'd interpreted in the same way they had, I'd be feeling the same way. So I'm not going to make them wrong. All I want to do is try and give them some new references so they might have a new perspective, because that's how we develop new beliefs, by new references. Now, you can realize that certain references, in spite of being given, can be ignored to maintain an old belief. But I'm also here to tell you, if someone gets enough new experiences, enough new references, oftentimes you can trigger and create a total change. And that's one of the reasons I do the firewalk. I can talk to you all day long about the power of your brain, and you can go, yeah, I know I'm tapping less than 10% of my brain. Most people brag about that. But if I get you in a firewalk and I get you to get across this fire, 12 feet of burning hot coals, 1,500, 2,000 degrees, what happens is it's not like mind over matter. It's nothing special. But I'll tell you one thing, on the other side of that fire, it gives you an experience you won't forget. It's a new reference. And your brain says, if I can get myself to do this, what else could I get myself to do that I once thought was also impossible? Maybe fear is just false evidence that appears real, F-E-A-R. Maybe what we need to do is get new references, and the things we fear will be things we'll be able to utilize and move on. So if you want to shape your life, seek out references, more of them. Expand your life by expanding your references. Bottom line is, life is lived by being willing to constantly expand what we know and what we feel and what we do. Make sure you do it consciously. Make sure you interpret your life in a way that empowers you.